G'day, expats. Welcome to another episode of Expat Chat, episode 27. Today I'm joined by Jason Stock, who is a US CPA tax accountant. G'day, Jason. How are you going?
Hey, James. Doing great, thank you. Thanks for inviting me to the session. I'm speaking to you from California. Would love to be speaking to you from Australia right now.
I bet, but not in Victoria, because obviously Melbourne's just gone into a bit of a lockdown with that cluster. But no, we are quite lucky in Australia, especially where our head office is, Gold Coast. So I'm not going to rub it in. But how are you going in the US? Have you been vaccinated yet?
Yep, I've been vaccinated. It's going good here, like much better than compared to a year ago. Cases are dropping as we head into summer, so I'm hopeful things will kind of become a bit safer. But yeah, it's looking up, hopefully.
yeah, absolutely. Listen, ladies and gentlemen, the reason I've got Jason on today is I thought we'd do a bit of a special episode for our clients as well as expats based in the US and just go through a bit of a hit list of things that commonly come up with Aussies in the US, you know, PFIC, super, 401ks. The list could be endless, but we won't do an endless list today because we don't have that much time. But I think Jason and I were just talking before about some of the rules that came out with the recent budget update on the Australian side, you know, modernising tax residency. I think a lot of expats are pretty concerned. Because there just seems to be a lot of grey with that proposal, a one-page summary. I know Jason was mentioning before he did a webinar with America Josh and they were talking about it, trying to read between the lines. It's pretty difficult to pull apart at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very difficult. It's very ambiguously worded and there's not a lot of clarity as to some of the terms that they've used. So, you know, a lot of clients and a lot of people are kind of getting concerns because no one likes the unknown. We like black and white. So hopefully we get the answer soon.
Yeah, I mean, wait till the explanatory bill comes out and then I think we'll do another webinar and do our best to pull it apart. But I think the government and the ATO, they love ambiguity, just can't even say the word, because it allows a lot of, allows the ATO to read between the lines. You know, things can be maybe skewed in their favour. But the original, I suppose, one-page summary as part of the budget, it came from the Board of Taxation's report that was given to the government. It was dated March 2019, but I think the government picked it up December 2019, so not a surprise there. And it doesn't really account for a world that we live in right now, COVID-19 being rampant, people or expats being stuck in countries or stuck in their home country and can't get back out. And the fact that they're bringing in these hard rules, the bright line test with the 183-day rule, that makes sense. That's bringing us up in line with, I suppose, how the US can operate with a substantial presence test or the UK especially. But the other, I suppose, factor tests, the overseas employment rule, 45-day rule, economic connections, all these other things, I think that's the real concern for expats because it means that we can easily accidentally become an Australian tax resident, you know, overnight. So it's something that we need to be mindful of. But before we move into it, I'm just going to do a short little disclaimer. So again, today it's mainly for information and entertainment purposes only. Whatever you hear today, it's not personal advice. It's not general advice. It's obviously mainly just an education piece. If you need advice, you know, speak to Jason. His contact details will be in the notes under the video or reach out to us or speak to a tax attorney as well. So again, purely for entertainment purposes only. So why don't we jump into it today? Jason, can you give me a short little background of your history? Because you used to live in Australia. So, and I can hear that in your accent as well a little bit. So what was your background in Australia when you're living here?
Yeah. And I'm glad you gave the disclaimer that it's for entertainment purposes only, because I know everyone loves talking about tax. It's super fun.
It is.
Yeah. I'm Australian born and raised, grew up in Sydney, and then I moved to America, you know, in 2013. And similar to, you know, a lot of other Aussies, you know, coming tax time, you know, it almost seemed too easy, TurboTax, H&R Block.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of red flags for me because I am a chartered accountant in Australia as well as a CPA in America. And, you know, they weren't asking certain questions, you know, like, what do you have in Australia? Basic That's things right. like that.
Yeah.
And so I ended up doing the research, educating myself and training and all of that, and doing my own returns and, you know, kind of eyes wide open. And then some of my friends that were living in, you know, New York with me and stuff like that, they were blind to what was going on. And then when I flagged it with them, you know, all of these issues came up. And then
sounds like you opened up Pandora's box for them.
yeah, it was kind of a crazy experience. And then, you know, as businesses grow, you know, word of mouth, you know, I was doing returns for friends, I was giving advice for friends, then word of mouth, more people, it snowballed.
Yeah.
And yeah, that kind of led Uptrend Advisory to today. But it's been a journey. I was living in Sydney after moving back from New York for a few years. And then I married an American, which is pretty classic.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then we moved to California last year, just in time for the pandemic. So it's really, really good timing.
Just in time. But I guess, you know, one thing which I know when I speak to clients and expats that are in the US, they love hearing that, you know, we know an accountant that, you know, obviously comes from Australia, technically, we'll claim you. And I guess, you know, you have a firm understanding of the tax gap between the US and Australia, or the ATO and the IRS. You actually have an understanding of different tax vehicles, you know, family trusts, self-managed super funds, companies, partnerships back in Australia because of your previous background, you know, being a chartered accountant in Australia. Do you lean on that chartered accounting anymore back in Australia? Not really. I mean, it sounds, you know, obviously you're mainly probably focused on the US side now.
Yeah, so I would say I'm more heavily towards the US side, but having that chartered accountancy in the background and having an understanding of the Australian tax laws, super helpful, because you almost can't make an informed decision without understanding each side of the coin.
Yeah.
Because otherwise you could potentially be leaving yourself exposed to something, and it's not a good place to be.
No, not at all. And I mean, what you mentioned before about a lot of people, you know, using your traditional accounting models, H&R Block, your ITP specials, your TurboTax, which seems like every Aussie's over there has used TurboTax at some point. That's usually where the issues come from, because obviously it doesn't have the prompts to ask these questions. Come across people which never lodge an FBAR, and they usually go, "What's that?" And go, "Well, are you using TurboTax on one of these types of platforms?" "Yeah, we are." "Okay, great. Let's get you all squared away. Let's move you over to an account that knows what they're doing." So those are some of the issues that we come about, and some of the issues that we'll talk about today are really common. You know, they're sort of something that expats need to somewhat red flag before they head over to the US, which is very common that they don't. And I thought, why don't we dive into, you know, what a passive foreign investment company is, PFIX, because it's very common that if we have shares or ETFs or managed funds back in Australia, that, you know, essentially we could be holding a PFIX. So, you know, Jason, what is a PFIX in the eyes of the IRS? You know, what's the definition, I guess you could say?
Yeah, so the PFIC is definitely one of those common pitfalls that, as you said, no one knows about until it hits them.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can know about it before you go, then, you know, someone like yourself can help a client get around this before it even becomes an issue. But to answer your question, passive foreign investment company is essentially something like a mutual fund, an index fund, and exchange traded funds. You know, people invest in Vanguards in Australia, those types of things can be viewed as a PFIC.
Yeah.
Now, why it would be called a PFIC is, firstly, is it foreign domiciled from the perspective of the US? So Vanguard Australia is domiciled in Australia. Therefore, it meets that test. The next test would either be the passive income test or the asset test. The passive income test is, does that Vanguard Australia, as an example, generate more than 75% of its income from passive sources? So interest, dividends, capital gains, royalties, those things, yes, it would meet that test.
Yeah.
Otherwise, if it didn't meet that test, then it's the asset test, which is if 50% of the assets are used to produce, you know, interest, dividends, capital gains, royalties. So it pretty much covers most funds that aren't in the US.
Mm.
So that is what a SIFA is.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a wordy definition, and I mean, it's really common, you know, Aussies that are heading over to the US, or for that matter, any expat that's heading into the US, a lot of them will usually lean on index funds, ETFs, easy to understand, easy to buy, easy to hold, easy to follow a dollar cost averaging sort of contribution strategy to them. But again, you know, they're the type of asset that we probably shouldn't hold. I think in Australia, there's probably only two ETFs on the market, which are still domiciled inside the United States, even though they're listed on the ASX. You know, there's only one way to get around it. So with that in mind, it means, yeah, you need to be very careful, you know, manage funds, listed investment companies, Australian Real Estate Investment Trust, you know, all those that are traded back here in Australia are going to be a PFIC. So you need to be very mindful of the way you sort of, I suppose, invest. You know, it might be a case where you're just investing in directly listed ASX blue chip shares. You know, that might be the approach because that's just an operating business and the US acknowledges that. It's a weird piece of legislation they brought in. And I think they brought that PFIC rule back in the 90s, to be honest. I think it was a very long, was it 80s? Correct me if I'm wrong. I think it's 90s, early 90s. I feel like it was a under the hand table deal done between the IRS and maybe BlackRock and Vanguard saying, let's keep the money in the US. Let's disincentivize US tax residents sending money overseas. It makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, it's a good strategy. It's worked for them. Some people have PFICs that they can't get away from just because they can't or they don't want to. And, so, you know, it's a win-win for the IRS. I guess to understand, you know, what's bad about holding a PFIC, you know, there's two things. The first is the taxation of the PFIC. And the second thing is, you know, paying someone like me to do the PFIC forms because
they're expensive.
Very, very complicated form.
I've seen them. They're too long, to be honest. And I don't understand the questions in them half the time because why does the IRS need to know that? So, I mean, you're right. Yeah. I mean, the tax, obviously, I guess you could call it a penalty tax, a higher rate of tax. And then the forms are, what would you say, minimum 10 page per PFIC or maybe sometimes more?
Yeah, and there's a lot of calculations as well that go in the background. Like it gets to the point of complexity where, you know, there's actually services that actually sell themselves to accountants as PFIC calculators. That's how complicated and into the weeds it can get.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that is, okay, let's say you have one PFIC. That's not so bad.
Yeah.
What does that PFIC invest in? Does it invest in sub-PFICs?
Okay.
You can then go all the way down the rabbit hole and you've got many PFIC forms to report and it's just a nightmare in terms of tax and cost.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think I'm just thinking of one off the top of my head, Vanguard Australian Property, the ETF. It's an ETF that invests in Australian Real Estate Investment Trust. So, you know, you think about the flow and effect of that. So I suppose, is there any way that anyone, you know, I suppose expats, they can be exempt from reporting PFICs? Is there a different way they can go about it? Is it a low balance that they're holding in those PFICs where they can get out of reporting it at all? Or?
Yeah. So good question. There's, there is an exemption, so the IRS does have some kind of allowance, but
it's not
that high. So
when you're
filing a single or separately on your own in America, you have a PFIC exemption of $25,000. So if your aggregated PFICs added together are 25 or under, you're exempt from this form, and you can just report the dividends interest as normal, no penalty tax.
Yeah.
If you're filing married, that exemption goes up to 50,000 US. So it is good, but you know, a lot of Aussies heavily invest in ETFs because of the growth. And so they're likely going to be over that threshold.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Spoke to someone yesterday. They bought, it was maybe VAS or VAS, which is just Vanguard's Australian Share Index. They've got a few hundred thousand in it, and they bought it only 2 months ago and had to let them know what it was. And now they're scrambling to undo what they've done. So it's very, very common, unfortunately. You know, educate yourselves before you obviously invest. It's still good ways to invest. It's just, you know, doing it the right way so you're not causing issues long term with the IRS. We've covered PFICs or PFIC. I think that was a good topic to delve into. Obviously, if you're unsure, reach out. Jason or myself, we can tell you pretty quickly what you're holding, whether it's a PFIC, and obviously Jason can help unwind through the relevant reporting requirements as well. Now, this next topic is something which it's very hard. It's very hard to talk about superannuation, Australian super accounts. If we're in REST, CBUST, have an SMSF. SMSF, we actually have clear understanding of the treatment, but super as a whole, you know, what's your opinion on super as a whole when you talk about it with your clients, Jason, IRS, those sort of things?
Yeah, so I first, I guess obviously everything's grey and subjective with this subject matter. It's probably the most controversial topic when it comes to Australians.
Yeah.
Because of the gray, there's no black and white answer as to how things are treated. So
that's right.
Everyone has their own view. But, you know, in terms of that conversation, I asked them what type of super fund they have. And so I understand from that point, is it an industry super, you know, like a REST, a Host Plus, or is it, you know, a self-managed super fund?
Yeah.
And that kind of then has a decision tree knock-on impact. So the SMSF we can get into, because that one you already know how to treat it once you know it's an SMSF. But
that's right.
The retail fund, you then need to understand over the life of the fund who has contributed more to that fund, the employer or the employee.
Yep.
And the reason why I like to know about that is because of control.
Yes.
Because control can be defined in many different ways. You know, can you withdraw funds from your super? Yes, everyone can. Can you choose how to invest? Yes, you can choose a risk appetite portfolio and things like that. But this one is the big one as well. So if, you know, it's mainly made up of employer contributions, that helps me understand that, okay, based on that, we're going to view you as not having control over that super fund, and we will state the balance on the appropriate forms, but we will not state the growth as taxable.
Yeah.
Contributions, though, would be considered taxable. So I get a lot of questions from clients asking me, oh, should I be contributing to my super? Should I be maxing out all of that?
Yeah.
And I tell them not to.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's the same here. I mean, because if they've got a super fund, you know, a retail super fund, industry super fund, where, you know, the balance has been borne about from that super guarantee rate, you know, your 9.5%, or, you know, if they're a government employee, 10, 12%, whatever they get. Lucky bastards. But if it's mainly been born about from the employer, and then they start contributing to it aggressively while they're in the US, well, they're slowly going to change that control. 50% over, you know, 10 years might change from the employer previously now to the employee, or I suppose the member. And it's just like, oh, okay, we've now got to go back to square one. Might be a foreign grantor trust or change the treatment. So it makes sense. And there are plenty of individuals that are in the US, plenty of expats that are working for sort of a global employer where that employer will be kicking in an amount into their Australian super as part of that sort of, I guess, tax equalization that's being done. But usually and normally the account is including those contributions in their accessible income. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, correct. So that's kind of like the most basic situation, which is...
Yep.
Where I'd say the majority of my clients fall into.
Yeah.
Then, you know, when it is viewed that you have control through, you know, those tests, or whether you have an SMSF, that is when it starts not to get fun. So,
walk me through the SMSF. I mean, foreign grantor trust. Before we dive into it, one thing which came out recently with the budget, the Australian federal budget, was they're relaxing the rules around SMSF, or I suppose members of SMSFs, where essentially the safe harbour rule is going from 2 years to 5 years. So expats that are non-residents, and they're also relaxing the active members test. So it means an expat or a non-resident once they legislate this new piece of legislation, it's not in effect now, so don't go ahead and start throwing money into an SMSF while you're overseas, is essentially you can breach the active member status, so you can start contributing whilst you have an SMSF. Don't do it if you're in the US, if you're in the US, but you can keep an SMSF going for 5 years before you need to either make some structural changes. This is just for expats as a whole, not obviously specific to the US. But yeah, let's go into SMSFs, foreign grantor trust. You know, what do we need to know?
So foreign grantor trust, SMSF, you know, it's a trust that you clearly have control over, where to invest, when to take distributions, how much to contribute, all of those things. It's it's very, very clear. Yep. So what that would mean is you have to complete two specific forms annually. Called a 3520 and the 3520A, where you're essentially declaring your contributions plus growth of that SMSF annually as taxable income. Yeah. So it is not a great situation to be in. No. And I know, you know, James, I know that you help a lot of clients when you know that they're going outbound to America. This is one of the topics you handle that you make them aware of this, and then you you wind down, restructure so that they can get away from this type of designation.
Yeah, that's right. I think right now, me and the team, we're scrambling to wind down an SMSF for a client that's coming on because, you know, they're landing in the US very soon. And, you know, we're trying to get this SMSF back to your traditional industry or retail super fund type treatment. So it's an employees benefits trust, those sort of considerations. And we also, if it's an SMSF, don't want them holding PFICs or anything like that. But I mean, the biggest issue, I suppose, for expats is, okay, I have an SMSF, I'm heading to the US, I have a property in the SMSF, what do I do? Well, there's not too much that can be done in the event you don't want to sell that SMSF. You could roll it back to a small APRA fund, but very likely that probably the IRS will still treat it as a foreign grantor trust, unfortunately. It's just changing, obviously, and moving the trustee over to a company that sort of manages it, but because of its makeup, very likely foreign grantor trust treatment. But sorry, I cut you off there, Jason, but yeah, foreign grantor trust treatment, clear, you know, it's clear how to treat it. With foreign grantor trust, is there the PFIC issue as well?
Yeah, so two other things with the foreign grantor trust. So yes, you know, what if your SMSF holds that Australian Vanguard fund, which you just talked about, the same issue persists. So you're going to have the PFIC forms as well as the foreign grantor trust form. So if you know about this before you go to America, please, you know, talk to someone like James, because there's no reason you should ever fall prey to this, because you know, you've got plenty of lead time to do this. Then if you do have it and you are in the US and it's too late, then, you know, you're going to have to do this reporting, but potentially there could be a way to restructure it so that you only have one more year to do it. And then you're free. The other thing which you, you know, kind of alluded to was, you know, winding down the SMSF and putting it in potentially another company or another Australian vehicle. We're going to get into that, but it is something to be careful of as well, because it's another potential pitfall. The IRS is pretty smart.
Well, I mean, I've heard of cases where people have been in the US, US tax residents, green card holders, and they've been there for a few years and they've held an SMSF and gone, oh crap, I need to wind this down. But you know, the IRS already knows that you have an SMSF. It knows you've got a foreign grantor trust. So they might think they're doing the right thing by then winding up, rolling all the funds over to another retail fund or something like that. From what I understand, the IRS doesn't treat that very well. I think it's treated as almost as distribution, which can mean that whole amount should be taxable. So it's, yeah, it's a tough situation and it's always best to try and wind up or restructure it before you land in the US, sort of trigger that US tax event.
Yeah. It's much better to never be in that situation than to be in that situation and try to get out of that situation.
Yeah, exactly right. Well, I mean, let's lead into the retirement accounts in the US. I mean, in Australia, we've got superannuation. It's a tax concessional or a concessionally taxed vehicle. It's 15% on income, 10% on long-term capital gains, and then tax-free, you know, when we retire and draw an account-based pension. even though it might be tax-free in Australia, if you're residing in the US drawing an income stream, well, it's obviously still going to be assessable by the IRS because unfortunately the DTA isn't that friendly between the countries. But if we move into 401ks, you know, what is a 401k? And I suppose, you know, why is it obviously a little bit different to a super account?
Yeah, so 401k is, for lack of a better word, the US version of a super fund. Mm-hmm. It's not as good as a super fund because you don't have the guaranteed employer contributions. So when you're taking a new job, one of the questions that, you know, should always be asked is, with your 401k plans, what is your match? And your match is finding out how much your employer is going to contribute to your 401k.
Yep.
Based on what you contribute.
Yep.
So that should be a part of your negotiation because it is free dollars that you are potentially losing out on or benefiting from. So what it does, what a 401k is, it's a retirement vehicle where you're able to contribute pre-tax dollars to a tax-deferred growth vehicle, which you would then withdraw from come retirement age.
Yep.
So when you retire, that is when you'll pay tax on what's within the 401k based on how much you draw on the marginal tax rates. The benefit as well to contributing to your 401k is it's a pre-tax deduction, so it can help you lower your taxable income annually while building something for the future too.
That's right.
So it's great if you're getting a match.
Yeah.
If you're not getting a match, you know, is that a good investment? I don't know. There might be a better way to deploy capital. James might have an idea too.
Got a few. I guess it's treated, it's almost polar opposite, to be honest, of a super account. You know, it's majority dime. If it's not a Roth, it's, you know, it's a standard 401k, then tax deferred, and then income stream when you're pulling it out and retired after 59 and a half, then, you know, you'll pay your marginal US tax rate on it, depending on the income stream you pull from it and probably from your other income sources as well, you know, shares, those sort of things. With I suppose 401ks, you know, right now when you look at the 401k providers in the US, it's annoying, actually. It's hit and miss with a lot of them. You know, you can take a treaty election on a withdrawal once you're over 59 and a half, and sometimes the platform, the 401k provider, won't withhold any tax. So that's good because you might not be in the US anymore, might not have any other ties to the US. You might just have this 401k. And you've done the right thing. You've waited till you're over 59 and a half so you don't get hit with the 10% penalty tax. Yep. And then when you withdraw it, if the treaty election is acknowledged, well, you've then got to work out, well, how's the ATO going to treat this? You know, it's not treated as a foreign super fund. No 401k or IRA or Roth, anything of that regard in the US is treated like a super fund. So when it comes back to Australia, the common treatment is usually a section 99B, which is a foreign investment trust in the eyes of the ATO. So it, you know, usually it'll have two components, the growth component from when it was first opened, and then the capital contributions from yourself and your employer. So obviously the growth is assessable, and usually the capital contributions aren't assessable by the ATO. So you can see how there's actually a bit of a gap in what's been taxed and what hasn't if a treaty election is acknowledged. But it is hit and miss, unfortunately, with the treaty elections taken on the withdrawals. Some platforms are really good and they'll acknowledge it. Some won't. They'll still withhold anywhere between sort of your 15 to 20%. And then you're probably incentivized to lodge a non-resident alien US tax return in case they've taxed you too much. So, you know, there's pros and cons of either, but either way, it's always worth just doing the research. Okay, if we take a treaty election, you know, are we going to benefit from that, or are we better off doing it from another 401k provider? Just so you're reducing your overall tax exposure.
Yeah.
But I mean, yeah, a really good topic. I'll admit, you know, I know some stuff about 401ks, Roths, IRAs, but I know they've changed the legislation over there where you can do this sort of backdoor 401k rollover or IRA rollover Roths or something like that. I'm not across that yet. So I'll have to do a bit more research, but that's something which I think a lot of Americans and expats have been benefiting from. I'm not sure if you know too much about that, but you're not the advisor, so I won't go into that, Josh.
Yeah. So the 401ks, you've pretty much hit every single mark on that. And so, you know, I guess this falls more into your wheelhouse, but, you know, with an expat in the US, There is a timing factor as to when they want to make that distribution. Is it, before leaving the US so that Australia doesn't tax it? Is it incrementally over years while in Australia, or do they wait until retirement age and then, you know, relocate to America to then, you know, take from this fund?
That's right.
And then, yeah, it's complicated and everyone's situation's different. What they have the appetite to do, what they are willing to lose from that fund. It's not a black and white answer, unfortunately.
It isn't. And timing's a really a good, I suppose, item you mentioned there, because expats, they might leave in the new calendar year. They've got no wage income in that calendar year, but they've got a 401k that's got $30,000 in it. And they're like, well, maybe I'll access that. Yeah, I'll cop the 10% penalty tax. I'll cop whatever my US marginal tax rate's going to be, because this is the only income I have. So I'm going to pay a reduced amount. Whether that's suitable for your situation, that's going to be up to you and your advisor and the advice you receive. But yeah, timing is always going to be a key factor, because at the end of the day, if you want to access it, it's, you know, when it's obviously going to have its lowest tax applied to it, both on the Australian side and the US. So yeah, it's a tough topic, but there's always ways and strategies that you can navigate that space. We'll move on to another good topic, which a lot of clients always talk to me about. They always know, ask me, James, what do you know about this? And unfortunately, happy to admit, not enough. So accidental Americans, obviously individuals that are born in America, obviously Australian parents, obviously they've got the dual citizenship, which kicks in. They should be reporting at some point, but they don't, and they are very fearful of even stepping inside the US now in case they're caught out. But it's really common, accidental Americans. I mean, do you see too much of it, or any of it, I guess, in your line of work?
So the accidental American situation happens pretty often. You know, an Aussie marries an American, they're living in America, they get their kid dual citizenship, and vice versa if they're in Australia. And more often than not, the child grows up to be an adult, has still kept their citizenship, but was never made aware that, you know, US taxes their citizens no matter where they are, and that you would have a filing requirement. So it's very, very common. You know, there's not a lot of them, but I've had enough people this year alone that have been in that situation. And what happens is, let's say, you know, you're in your 30s or 40s, you know, you're meant to be filing every single year. It's clear that you've got, you know, at least 10 years of past due returns that you haven't been compliant. Yeah, it's scary because, you know, there's this rule, there's this government body that's very powerful, and you're not doing the right thing. And yeah, you can get penalized pretty heavily. But thankfully, you know, there is a program that you can go through to kind of do a quick catch up with your US taxes. And it's called many different things, but overall it's an amnesty program. Based on your specific situation, you can qualify for certain programs. So there's one called the streamlined filing when you're offshore or onshore. There's the delinquent filings. They all have different qualifiers to determine if you're eligible for them. But the main trigger point for it is if your misconduct was non-willful.
And okay,
if you knew you had a filing requirement but chose not to, you won't be able to go through that procedure, and you'd have to, you know, submit normal tax returns and just hope you don't get penalized pretty heavily. But most people fall into the bucket of they actually just didn't know genuinely.
Well, I mean, I would have thought most expats, knowing what it means, would be like, or accidental Americans would be like, oh, I'll take that election because it's going to be treated a bit more favorably. Even though I knew I should have probably lodged, I might lean towards the non-willful election. But I guess it probably depends on previous lodgements, but maybe they submitted or anything they've done with the IRS in the past, whether they can even take that election. Because that's a hard one for, I suppose, anyone to prove as well.
What ends up happening is you have to write almost a legal document explaining, you know, all of the good facts and bad facts as to how you ended up in that situation. And the IRS reviews it with your returns, and then they make their determination on that basis. They might send you a letter asking for more information or things like that, but that's the way to go if you were non-willful.
Yeah, okay.
And similar to everything with politics and everything, the wording on slash definition of non-willful is not that great either.
I thought it might not be, especially the US IRS. It wouldn't surprise me. Okay, we won't go too much further into that one because it can be a Pandora's box, but you've given a pretty good rundown of what can be done. So that's good, you know. Back in Australia for Aussie expats, you know, this is probably the last topic we'll talk about, because I think what I'll do is I think we should do another episode. We'll do, you know, part B, because there's a few other topics that we should cover. But today, as part of the last topics, Australian vehicles or tax vehicles, I guess you could say, not Australian vehicles. We know that a few of them have shut up shop recently. But I guess, you know, when we look at family trusts, companies, partnerships, a lot of these are very common structures for expats to have, whether they've been doing business on their own, you know, self-employed, or where they've got a family trust with maybe a corporate trustee and their own property to that trust, or to an early retirement vehicle or whatever it might be, you know, suitable for someone that's an Australian tax resident residing here, but might not be so suitable when they head over to the US, because obviously you've now got to abide by how the IRS is going to treat these certain vehicles. So I thought we'd go into it just quickly, you know, family trust, you know, I guess when you look at the pros and cons, I mean, pros of a family trust, you know, obviously we can hold something where as an investment, we can deem and do the distribution minutes around now actually, and deem who's going to receive capital gains as part of the beneficiaries, or I suppose income distributions, those sort of things. The trust deeds of family trust, they're always worded very broadly. so you're given plenty of options around that. But, you know, from what you've seen whilst you've been in the US, you know, family trust, what are some of the pros and cons, even layering it with, you know, a tax side from the US point of view?
Yeah. So, you know, from a tax point of view, as you called out, you've got these tax minimization strategies, you know, who gets what and when. You know, if you have children in your trust, you know, you can do those distributions because of their taxable income. You've got the capital gains discounts when selling things, and you've got all of that asset protection. The US side, or I guess before going to the US side, the cons of, you know, the trust are firstly the administration of having to maintain it and do all the tax returns and everything like that.
Yep.
If your trust ends up taking a loss, you can't distribute it. So it's almost stuck within the trust.
Yes.
The last part is that, you know, if you have a property and you've given it to the trust owns it, not you. So you're losing ownership of your assets to that trust. It's multi-purpose, but it's not perfect. It's got to be fit for purpose and what you're trying to do with your strategy for, you know, wealth building and protection. From a US standpoint, not great. So
I was like, oh, hang on, maybe. Well, let's see. What are you going to say? Not great at all. I know.
So what I mean by that is how the IRS will view your trust slash even if you might not have to report your trust, it just depends on a few things. So who the trustee is of the trust.
Yep.
You know, if it's you, then you would be viewed to own that trust. Then you would have to report that trust on your US return, similar to how the SMSF would be reported and taxed.
Yeah.
The other thing is, let's say you're not the trustee and so you don't own the trust and you've got a corporate trustee, which is super common in Australia, but you own the shares in that corporate trustee, you then indirectly own the trust and you still have to do that reporting, as well as a foreign corporation return for the corporate trustee. So that's the trustee. The next level is the beneficiary. So let's assume you're not a trustee at all, you're clear, direct and indirect ownership. If you're just a beneficiary of the trust, you don't need to report anything to the IRS unless you receive a distribution, in which case you will report your distribution and pay the tax less the tax credits paid to Australia.
Yep.
So it's good as long as it's not pointing towards you, I guess.
Yeah, well, I mean, you're spot on. So many family trusts, they'll have the corporate trustee, which is usually just the PTY or TD company, which is usually not a very creative name either. You know, Ridley Family Trust, and then it's Ridley Pty Ltd or something like that. But you see some funny names, Money for Jam and those sort of things. But yeah, usually it'll be the directors, mum and dad. They're also the shareholders of the corporate trustee, the beneficiary and the family trust and so on. Sounds like, you know, the best structure is, okay, well, don't be connected to it from a trustee level. If you're a beneficiary, that's probably not terrible, but then what kind of income are you receiving from it and how's that being taxed as well? I'm not the biggest advocate for family trusts when we're non-residents, but it depends on the asset class that we're holding in that trust, because there's definitely more tax efficient ways to invest. But again, coming down to the asset class, and as we've just been educated by Jason, the IRS IRS is just ridiculous. I mean, when it comes to over-disclosure taxation, but obviously when you're using an accountant, it can be easier to navigate. What about Pty Ltd's companies? I know a lot of expats that are in the US, but they'll still have an old Pty Ltd, you know, a self-employed entity that they might have operated of back in Australia. And sometimes they'll even use it to invoice from the Australian side whilst they're in the US. What are some pitfalls that we run into?
Yeah, so, you know, besides the pros and cons of owning a company, you know, that's, you know, you can talk to that, I can talk to that. But in terms of the pitfall, you trigger one of the most complicated tax forms that the IRS has, called a 5471, which is the foreign corporation return, which is like a tax return within a tax return itself. They have, you know, this year they've expanded their classifications, but they essentially have different types of like filings of that return. You know, are you a chapter one owner, a chapter two, a chapter three, four, five? And now this year they've added 1A, 1B, 1C through five. And it's really, really complicated. Essentially what will happen is, depending on your ownership, depending on your directorship, depending on, you know, if it's a controlled foreign corporation, depending if you have globally intangible income, you know, it's, you're ultimately reporting your corporation's business affairs through that form, and you will likely be ending up paying tax on your business's profit on your personal return, less the tax paid to Australia. But that form itself is very complicated. And so just be aware, if you have that, you are going to be paying a lot to have a tax professional do that form, because
it's not an easy tax return.
I suggest you read the instructions for it and you'll see.
I have no doubt. So yeah, I guess expats that are in the US, if you're still doing some sort of work or business for clients that are back in Australia, you know, consider only doing it from the US side rather through the Australian system. I mean, a non-resident that's running a Pty Ltd back in Australia, they also need to be careful. You know, they're a non-resident, you know, if they're the only shareholder, they're still having to declare everything to obviously the ATO. If they're still receiving that as director's fees or a wage, you know, they're a non-resident. So they're still paying one third in tax as a minimum on the individual level to the ATO. So what's the point? You know, maybe they should be looking at, so maybe they should be looking at a US new entity, Pty Ltd equivalent, and invoicing out of that. That would make sense. That would map to the fact that they're a non-resident as well. Sorry, Jason, you go.
Yeah, that happens quite often. I receive inquiries asking, what's the best way to structure? Should I have the Pty Limited, or should I have the LLC or S Corp or C Corp? And you know, if you're planning on staying in America and having international business, you know, Australia or other countries, you're better off having a US structure as opposed to a structure that is foreign and therefore treated in this manner.
Yeah.
So, yeah, again, making sure you're doing something that's fit for your purpose and your strategy.
With Pty Ltd's, back in Australia, I mean, is it best that an expat, you know, if nothing else is going on, it's just an empty shell now, is it best that they wind it up, or can they just stick it on ice, put it as a shelf company, do a nil return lodgement each year? Or because they still own it and still have, you know, something there, do they still have to report that, or is it best they just cut ties with it?
Yeah, so I've had this a lot where it's, you know, dormant. I tell them, okay, are you going to use it for anything? If you're not going to use it for anything, wind it up, because Otherwise, you're just incurring an expense for no reason. The IRS does allow you to file that 5471 through a dormant procedure, which means instead of doing all of the pages, you just have to do the informational page, but it's still an unnecessary cost. And same on Australia side, from having all of those maintenance and having an accountant do everything. So if you're not doing anything with a vehicle, you should not, you like, it makes no sense to that vehicle.
That's right. Yeah, I agree. I mean, an accountant in Australia can set up a PTY LTD very quickly and register for GST and all those sort of things. So the only reason I suppose an expat might keep it, which I can think off the top of my head, is it's got tax credits from previous years, or it's got income losses carried forward and they're keeping it as an investment vehicle for the future. Still going to require obviously the lodgements, as Jason just said, and that's the only reason you'd be keeping it. If you're not using it and you're not going to use it for the next 5-10 years and there's nothing in it, what's the point in having it? So yeah, you know, coming to those logical decisions, it makes sense. Jason, what I might do now is we might wrap it up there. It's been actually an amazing call. I think a lot of expats are going to actually take away a lot of information from this, and you've either scared the crap out of them or they're going to walk away and go, okay, well, these are the little things that I need to be mindful of going forward. These are things I need to actually have looked at. And that way, you know, it's probably a breath of fresh air, you know, transparency there. So we'll wrap up there. What I'm going to look at doing is do another episode with Jason. There's a few more things I want to discuss with Jason: home ownership in the US, green card, exit tax considerations, the amount of inquiries I get about that. It's a huge topic. And then one that's really common, especially where you're based right now, is, you know, especially in the tech bubble, RSUs options, those sort of things. What are they? How they're taxed when you receive investing grants, all those sort of things. It's a common question I receive, and I'm not a US tax accountant, so I always defer to your judgment. So it's something we'll talk about on the next episode. But Jason, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you, James. It was fun. And yeah, look forward to doing it again. And, you know, I hope that no one is scared from this. It's just better that you know than you don't know.
That's right.
So that you can, you know, decide based on what you want to do.
Yeah. And I mean, you can take reassurance that there are professionals out there that know how to tackle these things as well. So, I mean, that's something that you would have learned today from just speaking with Jason. So again, thanks for stopping by, guys. And look out for the next episode on Expat Chat. Cheers, Jason.
Cheers, James.